Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and we've created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. And we hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. Thank you for listening. My guest today has enjoyed a stellar career in the world of finance, first in equity sales, then as the founder of his own brokerage business, Execution Limited. Having built it, he sold it 10 years later and became chairman of Espirito Santo Investment Bank in London. And 8 years ago, founded the Curation Corporation, where he remains the chief executive. Nick Feingold, it's great to have you on the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you for having me, Si.
Let's touch on the early years. I think that after school, you went to Manchester University. Was that all part of a master plan to end up in finance?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's obvious that if you want to get into finance, the best way to possibly get there is to get a third class honours degree in textiles from the University of Manchester Institute of Science and Technology. It was a clear plan all along.
And so how did your thinking change?
My thinking changed when I needed to get a job, really, after I left university. So I remember sitting around a table with two first-class honours degrees from Oxford, two first-class honours degrees from Cambridge, one from Bristol, Durham, Exeter, and two guys from the army in those days. And the first question in my interview was, I've got six people with first-class honours degree. You have a third in textiles. Why should I give you a job? It's just not the easiest question to answer, that's for sure.
Well, how did you answer it?
I basically said I had 3 years at Manchester University. During that time, I was lazy, selfish, self-indulgent, drunk too much, had the three best years of my life, met amazing people. And if I had my chance again, I'd do it exactly the same way. And the guy rocked back on his chair and he just went, well, actually, it was a bit like that for me at Bristol. So I got a bit lucky, I suppose, is the bottom line.
And where was your first job?
It was at Wood Mackenzie, which at the time was a wonderful, amazing stockbroking firm that had sort of got really big off North Sea oil. And their research department is the Wood Mackenzie of today, which was spun out of the brokerage firm and has gone on to do amazing things as well.
Right. So you moved through Wood Mackenzie and NatWest and Deutsche Bank. And said by one of our guests last week, Dave Yarrow, and also by the co-founder of the Money Maze World Champion, that you became one of the most successful salesmen in the city. And even if there's an embellishment in there, what were the ingredients that helped you make it such a success?
I think you have to love people. You have to genuinely like people and be social. So I think the best salesmen are always people that are affable and enjoy their job. But also, I think that the fundamental problem and what most people fail to understand in sales is it's about telling people what you're bad at, not necessarily telling people what you're good at. So to me, you're never selling cars or stocks and shares or furniture or houses. You're selling credibility. And in order to be credible to somebody, you've got to let them know what your flaws are and what you're bad at, in order to be believed. And I think in that regard, I was bad at an awful lot of things. So I was very, very honest with my clients about my flaws and also the ability to put a smile on people's faces. I've always understood that if people are going to listen to this podcast or if people are going to listen to my or read my blog, The Fat Gladiator, there has to be something in it for them other than just a lecture or a sales process. You have to make it enjoyable. Then people listen to you, I think.
So you navigate this path of equity sales, but at some point in time decide to go it on your own, which is a bold move. Tell me a little bit about the thinking, please.
At the time, Deutsche Bank was a AAA rated bank and it had huge, enormous aspirations. And we were tasked with building a global equity business. I think we went from like $0 to $5 billion of revenues in the first 3 or 4 years, which was pretty astonishing. And there were some amazing people there at the beginning. But there came a time about 4 or 5 years into it, and I suppose this is a technology lesson for everybody, where they started to put technology in the dealing room that was designed to make everything more efficient and help a buyer find a seller in much the same way that eBay might help a buyer find a seller. We were trying to do that from a technological perspective with stocks and shares, and it was very early and we were very cutting edge at the time. But then all of a sudden I started to realize that everybody could see what I was doing, and there were different departments inside of our own bank that were front running my customers' orders, which they used to call proprietary trading. And so, you know, I get an order to buy $100 million of a certain stock, and we'd make sure that we were very secretive and that the order didn't leak and that we kept it very quiet and tried to represent the customer. But meanwhile, we were being front run by our own derivatives desk. So the stock was up 3 or 4% and we hadn't bought any shares. So at that point, I realized that we had sort of a little bit like all technology. If you see it with Facebook today, you have a brilliant idea, but then if you lose control of it, it can be used for both incredible good and incredible harm. And I saw that technology starting to cause incredible harm. So I thought, we need to do something about that. And that was the seed of the idea for Execution, which was essentially to create a stockbroking firm without any intervention from trading books, just a straight sort of eBay buyer meets seller in a benign environment where no one could hurt our customers.
Many people think about leaving the mothership to do something on their own, but what did you find to be the biggest challenge when you sort of set out?
The biggest challenge was how to settle a $100 million trade with no balance sheet. That was the single biggest challenge. And then finding someone that would let me move into their building without putting a year's deposit down was also a challenge. We ended up in this incredible warehouse in Brick Lane.
Well, clearly it worked. And 10 years later, you're in a position to start selling your business again. Tell me a little bit about how that process worked.
It's a very weird story, but essentially Espirito Santo at the time was sort of like the Rothschilds of Portugal. They were a family with an incredible history, and they had taken a stake in a rival and fallen out with them, and I managed to get them out of that stake at a very good price, and they were impressed by what we did, and it was basically a massive block trade. And they were impressed by what we did, and therefore they sort of slightly fell for us. And I think, like the proprietor of many businesses, I suppose I was very concerned about 20 basis points turning into 10 basis points, turning into 5 basis points, turning into 1 basis point. I felt like we needed a bigger umbrella, a bigger balance sheet, and a bit more protection in order to be able to modernize ourselves and compete going forward. So eventually we got that deal done.
So you become chairman of the organization, and are you already thinking about the next career move?
If any entrepreneur is honest, we built Execution into a $100 million revenue business. It had never, ever, ever lost money from day one. It was profitable. And then when you're under new ownership, there is a cultural change, which may not be their fault. So it takes 2 or 3 years to sort of get yourself into a deal and then get yourself out the other side. But I think it's fair to say I wasn't enjoying life. And it's no disrespect to our acquirers. It was just a very different culture working in a bank to working in a warehouse in Brick Lane with space balls and a karaoke video wall. So culturally, I think things started to change. And then when they start to change, you realize that you maybe want to move on and go and do the next thing.
But still, curation, as you'll explain in a minute, is a large step from Execution and capital markets. So I'm intrigued as to how you started to move in that direction, which was 10 years ago, was already quite early.
Funnily enough, curation is not such a huge leap away from sales and capital markets. I mean, one of the things we used to do as equity salesmen was we sat in front of a Bloomberg terminal and our clients would give us their stocks and shares to monitor. And we would look at 100 shares and we would put their share names into the Bloomberg screen, and the Bloomberg screen would spit out 100 stories, 90 of which we throw away and 10% of which we'd keep and go and speak to an analyst and then put stuff down Bloomberg messaging and say, here's the story and here's why you care. So we were curators, if you like, of the Bloomberg terminal, even in the equity sales days. So there is a natural sort of bridge to what we're doing now that may appear to be very different, but actually in some ways is quite similar. And it's sort of interesting that Michael Bloomberg jumped out of the dealing room at Salomon's or wherever he was working in the bond markets into technology and media. So for me, it was quite a natural progression rather than a natural one.
But I think Curation Corp describes itself as identifying solutions to help leaders transition to a more purposeful and sustainable future. Can you start to unpick that a bit, please?
The core reason for our existence is to curate information and to allow our customers to sort of cut through the noise and see exactly what's happening. So have everything sort of fact checked and sort of relevant and served up to them on a plate. So the actual process of what we do and how we conduct ourselves is we think there's a problem in the world, and that problem is what we call continuous partial attention, which is that people basically know a huge amount about a little, but really can't follow all the things they know. So what we try to do is we try to inject a process which allows people to follow the things which are most important to their organization. Now, it so happens that over time, over Curation's 6 or 7 years history, because we have a energy major as a client and because we have lots of large insurance companies and asset managers, that the core of our offering these days is environment, social responsibility and corporate governance. But actually the sort of process that sits behind that is really, let's curate the information, let's make people's information lives really easy for them. And then the subject matter that we specialize in has become ESG.
And how have you used technology to help facilitate that?
We've sort of built a mini Google, really. It's kind of got 200,000 hand-summarized articles all relating to environment, social responsibility, and corporate governance. And so Google is a brilliant piece of technology, but it is advertising-driven, and it is designed to make you spend time looking for stuff. That's why it's worth $800 billion. And our search engine is designed to do the absolute opposite, which is to allow you to find exactly what you're looking for immediately. And then it sort of works a bit like sort of Spotify, which is that you can pull out these signals and create collections. But instead of creating a country and western collection with Dolly Parton in it, you're creating a social purpose collection, or you're creating a carbon offset collection. So out of the very best of the best of the articles that we've collected.
So I want to dive into one of the areas where I know you've spoken and written a lot, which is the energy challenge facing us in moving to a post-hydrocarbon world. In particular, you've been an advocate for nuclear. Can you maybe just start to explain a little bit about how you've arrived at that position?
If you look at the current crisis that we're in, one of the things that Curation does is it tries to highlight blind spots, highlight things that are hidden in full sight. But because it's a busy and noisy world, as I think it's E.O. Owen said, we are drowning in a sea of information whilst being starved of wisdom. And when you look at the current pandemic, and I'll move on to why the current pandemic is so important and how it leads into the question on nuclear, which they might not appear to be connected. But as a disciple of Bill Gates, I've been following what he's been saying for many years. He clearly warned us about the pandemic 6 years ago, but really there are numerous warnings. There are numerous alarm bells that went off, whether it was the recurrence of measles and mumps in the West, or whether it was SARS and MERS in the East. And then you look at some very plain statistics and you sort of look at what countries spend on national security. So a government's primary objective is to safeguard its citizens. And you see that they're spending minute fraction of the national security budget on pandemics, and they're spending hundreds of billions on weapons of mass destruction and armies and all sorts of other things. And you look at that, and when you hear Gates say, well, if there's one thing that's going to kill 10 million people, it's much more likely to be a virus than a war. And it leaps off the page at you, and it goes to you, how can that be right when we've had MERS and we've had SARS, we've had these warnings, we've got a recurrence of measles and mumps and all of these diseases that we thought had disappeared are starting to come back again. And then you're spending a tiny, tiny fraction of the budget that you should be spending on getting prepared for this pandemic. And this pandemic, I mean, it's just my great hope with nuclear is that the tragedy of the lives that we've lost over the last 3 months will not be in vain. If we learn from this and prepare ourselves for what we need to do on climate change. And so the statistics on nuclear versus fossil fuels, almost or even more stark than the national security budget spend of hundreds of billions versus the $4.5 billion I think we needed a year to have adequate PPE and testing in place, right? When we've seen 12 or 20 trillion knocked off the stock market. But we lose 8 million people a year to ambient and indoor pollution and smoke, according to the World Health Organization. And 91% of the world's population lives in unacceptable levels of air pollution. So you're losing 8 million a year to air pollution. And if you add up all of the nuclear disasters in history and times by 10, you might come to 200,000. And most of those nuclear disasters, when you start to read into depth about how they occurred, were utterly preventable with modern technology. So you have this incredible scenario where environmentalists are asking for nuclear power to be banned. And if you, again, you listen to Gates, there's a very simple equation, which is P, population, times S, which is services, times E, which is energy, times C, which is carbon. So to get to a zero carbon world, one of those letters has to be zero. So he started building a nuclear reactor. There are other people that are interested in the space. NuScale is another reactor company. They're about small, safe, scalable nuclear reactors. And they are the potential cure to the climate change conundrum. And we're going to have a second bite of the cherry, which is that we really need to reassess our views on nuclear. And somehow we have to decouple nuclear power from nuclear weapons in the mind of the electorate.
How do you reconcile one of those stark contradictions? I think 70% of French electricity is produced via nuclear power, and yet its neighbor, that won't be excluded from any accident, has been obviously going in absolutely the opposite direction.
Germany is going after hydrogen in a big way. And not only is Germany next to France, but the French nuclear reactors are old. So Chernobyl was 1940s technology with 1950s implementation, and Three Mile Island was 1950s, 1960s sort of tech, and Fukushima was slightly more modern than that, but not an awful lot more modern, but they left the backup generators below sea level. So when the tsunami hit, the backup generators failed, and then the reactor goes into meltdown. Those are all pretty avoidable mistakes, but there are different energy strategies from different countries around the world. In Asia, they're much more keen on trying to build a hydrogen society. And again, because of Fukushima, inherently biased, no doubt, away from nuclear power, which I think is our salvation. I mean, you just have to look at the Chinese cities and people choking on smog. In Delhi last year, it triggered a national emergency. Pollution levels got so high. So one of the wonderful things about one of the only wonderful things about COVID is obviously the positive impact it's had on the environment. But I don't think wind and solar, because they're intermittent, number one, scale, or number two, get us the whole way there. And if they did, you'd have a bunch of environmentalists screaming that the wind turbines are ugly and they make the environment look not nice. So the Extinction Rebellion need to know what they're asking for. And I'd love to help them, or Mr. Gates would love to help them know what the answer is.
Well, that sort of brings us to this whole ESG question, which has gone from current to torrent. And could you just maybe frame the discussion in terms of facts and falsehoods as you look at that whole space and the allied to that, the investment rush to be seen to be adhering to best conduct?
Well, I think the first thing to say is it's an evolving space, and there is no taxonomy that I'm aware of that exists yet, which is complete. And by taxonomy, I mean, how do we even begin to start to measure whether an industry is green? Or how do you start to measure social purpose? How do you start to measure all of these different things? They are very, very difficult to measure. There are a lot of people, like in any new industry, selling snake oil. And there are a lot of people that are trying to create, if you like, green capital by bleeding green. And anybody that knows anything about ESG or the environment will tell you it's a minefield. It's a vastly complex area. When you hear Bernard Looney, the CEO of BP, speak, it's clear that he's a man that wants to do everything he possibly can to make BP as green as is humanly possible as an oil company, whereas Chevron in the States appear to not care at all in many ways about the environment, and they're just going to carry on trying to dig up oil. And so, again, if you go back to Gates, he's quite clear that divestment of fossil fuel companies, the stick without the carrot, is not very fruitful or constructive. So the idea that all asset managers are going to divest from fossil fuel companies because they're bad companies is a bit one-dimensional for me.
And so what's your advice to a large oil company that is working through this conundrum?
One of the mechanisms that sort of counts is just, are you doing the very best you can do within the industry you're in? And I use this example of the head of Marriott Hotels, who I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he's a gentleman of obviously great integrity. But he stands up and he was crying, as he almost crying on the videotape, as he let his 200,000 employees at Marriott go over the COVID-19 crisis. Yet that company bought back 5.1 billion of stock the last 2 years and didn't have that cushion to be able to continue to employ those people. On the other hand, you have Toyota, which is a car company and in ESG terms, a dirty industry because it's petrol and diesel and cars for the time being as they transition into electric and hydrogen anyway. And Toyota has 80 billion of cash in the balance sheet and hasn't let a single employee go. Now, tell me how you rate that. One's a dirty car company and one's a clean hotel company, but one let 200,000 people go and line the pocket of the C-suite and the other saved for a rainy day. And now it's raining. They're not letting a single employee go. Now, how you start to measure that is complex. I believe both companies are extremely well-managed companies, but with very different approaches to return on capital. And I think what we're going to see now, and I'd be amazed if this is wrong, is a de-emphasis on economic capital and a emphasis on social capital, or as we like to call it, jobs. We're going to need to create jobs going forward.
And a focus on balance sheets, not income statements, and a world where maybe 20 years ago, reserves were given higher consideration.
Yeah, I mean, up until now, social purpose has been something that most boards really played at. And there's been a huge amount of talk about diversity on boards and non-executive directors and the jobs that they fulfill. And it was an environment which, quite candidly, was pale, male, and stale. And although we've tend to have spent most of our time concentrating on the gender bias at boards. And of course, every board wants to welcome more women onto the board. But I'm personally much more interested about welcoming more scientists, more environmentalists, more philanthropists onto boards, regardless of their gender. That to me seems to be the skill set that needs to be most badly addressed. And if we had, look who's running the country now. It's scientists, not politicians. And I feel that boards would benefit greatly from scientific advice, environmental advice, and philanthropic advice going forward if they were serious about ESG.
So I think you author a piece called The Responsible Banker, which I'm sure people have quipped as somewhat of an oxymoron. But tell me a little bit about how that came about and which constituency you serve.
Well, The Responsible Banker is an initiative by UK Finance and powered, if you like, by Curation Content, which is designed to help banks transition themselves and their clients to a more sustainable and purposeful future. And it's kind of super interesting this time round because this crisis is not a financial crisis. And this time round, if the banks sort of help businesses get themselves back on their feet, they could be the saviors of the situation rather than the villains, as they may have been perceived to be last time round. So a super interesting time for banks. And I know that the banking sector is not just paying lip service to social purpose and to sustainability and to low carbon economics. They want to lead the world in that initiative. And The Responsible Banker is a concrete example of a sector that's actually doing something rather than talking about doing something.
So, Nick, I want to just change tack. You have also written on this whole theme of antibiotic resistance and now sort of evolution of the pharma companies and opening up source code. Tell us a little bit about how you think that journey goes.
If you look at what's happening currently with the virus, one of the things that's been talked about for years is antibiotic resistance. And again, using what we are currently learning about COVID, which is that pharma companies are giving up their IPs, their patents, they're sharing information, they're working with each other. The world is working with each other in a way to find a cure, which we've never seen before. But if we're successful in finding a cure for COVID because of this exemplary behavior by companies like AbbVie in the US and thousands of small initiatives and small biotechnology companies, we are uniting our information in a way that I've never seen us do before as we go after a cure. And that begs the question, why aren't we doing that with antibiotic resistance? Why aren't we doing that with cancer? Why, if we can try a vaccine on the human population now with the COVID vaccine, why can't we try more experimental stuff on people with terminal illnesses in areas such as cancer and further afield? So it's almost like moving fast and breaking things, which is what they used to talk about, the technology companies, has now sort of come to pharma. And if we ignore antibiotic resistance, like we ignore nuclear power or we ignore viruses, we're going to have a hideous shock. So we need to take what we're learning now and apply it to other fields, of which antibiotic resistance is just one.
So if you are going to make three observations on what you expect from the post-COVID world, what would they be?
Well, home working is definitely one of them that we're all sort of learning from. But the most interesting thing that's happening with home working from my point of view is that when corporate culture starts to recognize the contribution that you can make from home, then that is brilliant news for mums that have just had babies. It's brilliant news for people with disability. It's brilliant news for ethnic minorities that might not want to move from one community to another community for a big job. And it's amazing news for, if the government cares to listen, it's amazing news for things like HS2. Don't spend $110 billion on getting people to London an hour and a half quicker. Spend 50 or 100 billion in the north making that community better, and then set companies diversity targets. And so we have diversity targets for gender, for ethnicity, for disability. So why don't we do it for geography and sort of say 10% of your workforce has to come north of Watford, and then next year 15%, and next year 20%. And that means people can travel less, they can make a contribution to work, and you can regenerate communities in a permanent way. I mean, we saw a little bit of that with the BBC moving up north to Manchester. So home working is definitely one. The other thing I find slightly fascinating is there's quite a lot of economic work being done currently on prosperity without growth. And I'm not sure without growth is the right way of phrasing it, but prosperity with the right type of growth. And we have to get rid of this consumer society where people are buying crap that they don't need. We just have to. It just can't be right that we mass consume. And that doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't grow. It means to say that we need to grow in the right way. Because even at a 2% GDP rate, and the work that's being done in this area sort of suggests that actually there isn't a meaningful correlation between GDP per capita and how happy and fulfilled we are as a society, because Japan kind of shows you that. But at a 2% growth rate, I think the US economy would double by 2055. And that is without including some of the faster growing areas of the world, like China. So we're going to devour ourselves unless we learn to stop or learn to grow in the right way.
And just tell me a little bit about how you think supply chains will be reconfigured.
Well, supply chain sovereignty is going to be another thing that's come out of COVID, which is you can't be in that position again to get medical supplies from abroad when you need them, to get protective equipment from abroad when you need them, to get food from abroad when you need it. So this is, I think, pretty well documented that the era of globalization is, I don't know if it's drawing to a close, but it's decelerating at a extremely rapid rate, driven by environmental trends and technological trends. So you can, something like the automobile, a diesel car has 25,000 moving parts, an electric car has 25. So we went to the places that manufactured those 25,000 parts the cheapest, the dollar or the pound, ruled the roost. But actually, and you can probably going to be able to 3D print 25 parts and stick a battery in it and manufacture it in your own country. And why would we buy New Zealand lamb? Not because we hate Kiwis, but we wouldn't want the carbon footprint of a sort of lamb being flown over from New Zealand, particularly not from an environmental point of view, maybe from a taste point of view. And that's not an anti Kiwi policy. It's a anti-carbon policy. So there are all sorts of reasons why supply chains are going to be in some form of retrenchment, but mainly driven by the environment and mainly driven by technology. And those trends, I think, were very much in place pre-COVID, but have been accelerated by COVID.
So you've been in the investment world for most of your life, thinking for the next 5+ years, where would you want to be and not to be from a global investing standpoint?
There's a great debate in terms of the asset classes you might want to be in, but obviously the sweet spot is doing well by doing good. If companies can do well, doing well by doing good and make some money, that's a wonderful thing. The flip side of that is not every fossil fuel company is a pariah. How can you divest of fossil fuel companies and go home and turn on your lights and charge your phone and not be deemed to be a hypocrite? So I think that we're entering an age, I'm not so sure about which asset class or where I'd like to be, but I think we're starting to see a move away from active asset management towards activist asset management, where the fund managers and the pension funds that they manage are starting through investment stewardship committees to sort of play a more active and constructive role and giving companies the confidence to do well and do good at the same time. So that's kind of my great hope for the next 25 years.
So we have quite a lot of students and young people who listen to the show, and I note that you write on your website, hard work and positive attitude never go unnoticed. Are those the most important attributes that you'd like in a young person that you're going to hire?
I personally, I'd like them to either have a first or a third. I have an aversion to 2-1s and 2-2s. I mean, I obviously don't, but personality is always key. And if you're lucky enough to find something that you like to do, then working hard is really quite easy. And it's not easy for young people to find what their calling is. It's a difficult world. The jobs market's going to be really, really difficult and tough. But great people shine through. You can see it in their smile. You can see it in their positivity, their energy that they bring to the table. And usually, for me, it's always, there's always got to be a sense of humor there for me, because not because it's cool to be funny all the time, but that's how you hold people's attention when you want to get an important message across, in my mind.
And is there something that you know now that you really wish you'd known 30 years ago?
Outside how expensive it is to have 4 children. I may have only had 2. I certainly look back on elements of my past with a fair degree of, oh my God, was that really me behaving like that? I think we were born into a sort of slightly Thatcherite generation where it was like, go get it, go and get whatever you can, as much as you can. And that all felt pretty good at the time. I look back on that with some regret as to how I behaved, although I think that it was great fun.
Is there one person in particular in your life that you learnt from more than anyone else?
Well, I mean, the person I admire most in the world right now is Bill Gates. I think he is just amazing. I mean, obviously my father, my mum, my family and stuff like that. But for me, from a professional point of view, I mean, my dream would be not to make a huge amount of money so I could buy more things. It would be to make a huge amount of money so I could give it to him. And if I could meet one person in the world and spend time with one person in the world, it would be him, because he is a scientist, not a politician. And therefore, he looks at fact, not fiction. And that is what we need. We have to look at nuclear. We have to look at antibacterial resistance. We have to look at climate change. And there, we have to look at it through a scientific lens, not an emotional lens. And we have to educate our population as to who to vote for, and educate our politicians as to how to go about doing the work that's necessary So we need an electorate that understands the issues, and we need politicians that understand the issues, who are given a mandate to do something about it. Otherwise, we're going to end up in terrible, terrible trouble, I think.
Well, Mr. Gates, if you're listening, it's clear that we'd love to have you on the Money Maze podcast. That would be a very special moment. Nick, to finish up, do you have a favourite film and a favourite book?
I think probably Dead Poets Society, when he stands up on the desk at the end and they, my captain, monster crier. I'm a massive crier. I actually even cry at the Yellow Pages advert where he buys the new sit down lawnmower for the gardener. So my kids always joke about that. In terms of books, I don't know what my favorite book is, but I've only actually ever read two. Probably Enid Blyton, The Famous Five.
Back to solid roots. Nick, it's been terrific having this conversation with you. Thank you so much. I think that I've taken away two particular points, which is we are, to requote you, or quoting somebody else, we're drowning in this sea of information, but we really need to think carefully about what's useful and what isn't useful. And secondly, for those who are running companies and populating boards, thinking more intelligently about diversifying those boards by skills and by perspectives is a more valuable way going forward. So, Nick, I want to wish you the best of luck with the Curation Corp, and thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.